Hi, good morning, everybody. My name is Dominic. As you can probably tell, I've been a bit sick this weekend, so you'll have to bear with me, and I apologize in advance for any coughing along the way. But I am so excited to be here because today, I think this could be something this morning, this story we're going to look at today. We're in this series called Reroute, and the idea is that we all are in places, we're all looking to go somewhere, but at times, sometimes life throws us a curveball. Maybe that's something that you did. Maybe you went and made a decision. It led somewhere you didn't expect. Maybe you made a good decision. It led somewhere you didn't expect. Or maybe you're just kind of cruising through life, and life just threw you a curveball you weren't expecting. And you have to make a change. And so we're looking at different points in the life of David and his kingship. And today we're going to look at the story of David when he acts with incredible kindness toward one another. It's a story where David decides to act like God, and because he does, he's going to be able to reroute someone else's life for the better. It's a story of grace and compassion, of redemption and restoration, and I think it's a message that we all need to hear in our day more than ever. But before we kind of really get into the text this morning, I want to ask you a question. I'm going to put a question on the screen that I want you to consider. And here's the question. When is a time when someone was kind to you and they didn't need to be? Maybe think back to a situation in your life. Maybe it was something recent. Maybe it was a long time ago. When someone showed you kindness, when someone acted towards you in some way that you didn't deserve or some way that you didn't expect. And to give myself a break to catch a cup of water, I'm going to have you do something a little bit different that's going to kind of maybe make you a little bit uncomfortable, but I think it'll be good. I want you to talk to the person next to you or someone nearby to you and share your answer to that question, okay? If you're like one of those people like me and you're an introvert and you're like, I wasn't ready for engagement this morning, you can just kind of put your head down and everyone will think you're praying and just be really impressed by you. But for the rest of you, if you want to, just find someone for the next 2 minutes or so and share your response to this question. I'm sure someone would love to hear a brief version of a story when someone was kind to you when you didn't expect they didn't need to be. So go ahead and do that for now for a minute. I love hearing all the talking and the sharing. Go ahead and finish up the story that you're sharing and then we'll bring it back together. It's a good idea. Maybe if I'm sick, I'll just keep doing this. I'll just keep asking you questions all morning. You guys can just talk. This is really good. I hope you were inspired. Maybe you were able to share something of your story as well. I think we can all think about stories or experiences in our life when someone was kind to us. And the interesting thing about that is when someone's kind to us, and especially when they're kind to you for no particular reason or they didn't weren't required to or no one told them to, it really changes something in you if you can think back to those experiences. Maybe you shared a little bit about that. We're going to look at this story today of David, and David's going to act with this kind of kindness, and it's going to change the life of a guy in his world. So I want to take us to 2 Samuel chapter 9. 2 Samuel chapter 9, the text will be on my screen above me, but before we do that, if you join with me in a word of prayer. God, thanks for the ways that you've acted throughout history, the ways that you've acted through people like David and others, ways that we desperately need to hear today in our world. Even this idea of kindness, this idea that maybe the way that we treat one another could actually change our world. I pray that, God, we would be open to that, that we would be open to the places that you're challenging us to grow and to be new people, that we would leave here changed today. In Jesus' name. Amen. So the story begins in 2 Samuel chapter 9. 2 Samuel chapter 9 begins like this. David asked, "Is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" So David has set up his kingship in Jerusalem. He's made it. He's survived. He's kind of conquered it all. And so the question out there that he asked the people around him, is there someone that I can show kindness to for Jonathan's sake? Now, this word kindness in English is this Hebrew word hesed. And the Hebrew word hesed is, we don't really have a great English translation for it. You may see kindness or loving kindness in some older translations. But it really has these two ideas. One is about loyalty and the other is love. And often this word will be used about how, for example, how God views people like you and me, that he views it in loyalty to his covenant and also in love. David does the same thing here, that there was this oath that he made with probably his best friend at the time, Jonathan. And so in response to that oath, he remembers that and says, okay, in loyalty to that oath, I want to show love, kindness to someone. I want to show favor to someone. And particularly, I want to show favor to someone in Jonathan's line, someone in Jonathan's lineage. And so he asked this question of the people around him, and a guy named Ziba responds to him. This is verses 2 through 5. Now there was a servant of Saul's household, Jonathan's father, Saul, who named Ziba. They summoned him to appear before David, and the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" He says, "At your service," he replied. And the king asked him, "Is there no one still alive from the house of Saul to whom I can show God's hesed, God's kindness?" And Ziba answered the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He is lame in both feet." "Where is he?" the king asked. Ziba answered, "He is at the house of Machir, son of Amiel and Lodabar." And so David had him brought from Lodabar, from the house of Machir, son of Amiel. So they invite this guy Ziba in, and Ziba says, "Oh, you're looking for someone in Jonathan's line. Yes, there is someone." And Ziba's description of him is interesting. It tells us a lot in two particular ways. One, excuse me, he says that this descendant of Jonathan is lame in both feet. He's lame. Now, in that, how this happened was that that this young man, when he was born, his father Jonathan, David's best friend, was killed in battle, and the Philistines were coming after them. And the nurse who was caring for this young boy at this time picked him up and ran to try to run from the Philistines and dropped him, and he was lame in both feet, crippled, we're told. Now, what that meant in that day was that he was excluded. He was outcast. He was on the fringe. Hopefully for most of us, we don't see people that in our day that way, but there are people, there are places in this world that to be lame is to be outcast, to be other, to be cast aside. That's how Mephibosheth, this guy, would have been seen. So Ziba says that, well, there's this son of Jonathan still here, but he's lame. He's one on the outside. And not only that, but Ziba does something interesting. You may not even notice it here, but Ziba never even says his name. I said his name a minute ago. The author of this text will say his name in a minute from now. But Ziba never says his name. He says, "Oh, yeah, there's a guy over there." And you say, well, maybe that's nothing. Maybe it is. Maybe it's nothing. Or maybe it means something. Maybe that this guy that Ziba's talking about isn't even worth being named. It's just so far out there. It's so far, he doesn't even need a name. He's so far forgotten. He's so far ignored. He's just, "Oh yeah, that guy over there." And so you hear from Ziba, yes, there is a son, and he's lame in both feet. And you realize, oh, okay. We know a little bit about this guy before we ever meet him. His life is lived as an outcast. His life is lived as one who is forgotten and overlooked by others. But they bring him in, and here's what happens in verses 6 through 8. When Mephibosheth, the author now tells us his name, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. And David said, "Mephibosheth, at your service," he replied. "Don't be afraid," David said to him, "for I will surely show you hesed, kindness, for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table." Mephibosheth bowed down and said, "What is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me?" So Mephibosheth has lived this life on the outside, has lived life as a forgotten one, as an outcast one. In fact, now he's so far living, he's actually living in this place, Lodabar, that's actually northern corner of the kingdom. So even the place he lives kind of reinforces kind of how he sees himself and how he's been told who he is. And now he's in the very presence of the king. So there's no more hiding, there's no more being forgotten. Now he is seen for who he is. I mean, even this act where it says, I just find fascinating that it says he bowed down, which you think, yes, that's what you do when you're a king, when you get before the king. Yes, but here's one who's lame in both feet, bowing down. I mean, the amount of effort that would have taken to maybe put the crutches aside or whatever he was using. as well as the vulnerability of that act. Everyone around would have seen him for who he was. He's no longer forgotten now. He is seen, and Mephibosheth responds in two different ways to being seen by David. The first way that he responds is with fear. We see this from David's statement. He says, "Don't be afraid." Now, David took the kingdom all of it from Saul. Saul's all of his kingdom-ness was finished, and Saul had been killed in battle. Jonathan had been killed, and often in that day, when a new king took up office, they would often do away with the former rule. They would do away with the families of people before them. And so Mephibosheth, you gotta imagine that there's a sense of fear that when he's in Lodabar and someone says, "Hey, you need to go to Jerusalem to see David," you gotta imagine there's a sense of like concern. I mean, is this it for me? Is David just gonna wipe me out in front of everyone? I mean, he's on this long journey from the northern part of the kingdom all the way down to Jerusalem. Can you imagine what he would have been thinking that entire trip? Can you imagine the fear rising in him? He can't get out of it. All he thinks is that this might be the end. The second way that Mephibosheth responds is equally challenging. He responds with shame. Not only does he respond in fear, but he also responds with shame. He uses this phrase. He says, I am like a dead dog. Which is pretty graphic, quite honestly, right? Now, I have a dog. My dog is the most cute and cuddly dog there ever has existed in the world. I love my dog. I don't have a picture, unfortunately, next time. But I love my dog. He doesn't mean that. When he speaks about a dog, he doesn't mean, like, you know, I'm really cute and cuddly and people like to spend time with me. A dog in that culture was dirty. A dog in that culture wandered the streets. A dog in that culture ate from the trash. It was a scavenger. It was not one that you celebrated. And so he says, I'm like a dog. I'm like one who's on the outside. In fact, that was an insult that people would often use. They would call one another a dog as a form of degrading. And he says, that's me. That's how he views himself. And not only as a dog, but as a dead dog. You can't get much lower. You got to imagine, it's like, Mephibosheth, how did you get to that point? But here he is, how he views himself. He views himself as unclean. He views himself as an outsider. He views himself as less than. He views himself as unworthy. Or to put it in one word, he views himself in shame. If you need a definition of shame, I like Brené Brown. She says shame is a fear of disconnection, this fear that we're unlovable and don't belong. That shame is the fear of disconnection, this fear that you're unlovable and that you don't belong. That's where Mephibosheth is. And he gets invited into the presence of David the king. And he's seen for who he is. You probably don't have to think too hard in your life journey to think about moments when you suffered shame. In moments where maybe a friend, maybe where a spouse, maybe an employer, maybe someone said something, did something, put you in such a place that you just said, you know what? I'm not worthy of connecting with another person. I'm not worthy of belonging. That fear of disconnection has so overwhelmed you. Maybe it's been you. Maybe it's your voice. I know, like me, that's probably more where it comes from is the messages I say to myself. So if you've ever been there, you can feel this moment for Mephibosheth and the weight of this moment for him. That somehow along the way that he exchanged and I experienced a tragedy for I am a tragedy. That somewhere along the line he made that jump that he should never have made. That shame somehow creeped into the picture. So here's Mephibosheth before David in his fear and his shame. He's seen for who he is, and watch how David responds. This is so fascinating. In fact, if you read it too quickly, well, we just read it, but if you go back again, it's so easy to miss. But David responds to his fear and to his shame by first naming him. Isn't that interesting? David's really the first person to speak his name in the story. The author told us his name, but David's the one who actually speaks his name out loud. When he shows up, he says, Mephibosheth. He speaks this guy's name. Ziba couldn't even speak his name. But David speaks his name. To name someone, I think, is to acknowledge their humanity. When you call someone by their name, when you move towards them, when I call someone by their name, I am acknowledging who they are. I'm saying, I'm willing to see you. I'm willing to hear you. I'm willing to give my attention to you. You have value. You have a voice. You are worthy of us connecting together. I speak your name. To speak someone's name is to see them as a person, to honor them, to show them favor. It's you are saying to them, I'm here and I'm listening to you. You and I have moments like this all throughout our weeks where we have a choice of whether or not to speak someone's name. Now, I don't necessarily mean literally, although I think that could be a good practice. But these moments where we could just treat someone as a step in our way. We could treat someone as an object to fulfill something. Or we could stop and see them as a human being in their humanity. To speak, David speaking his name was this communication, I think, that says, you're invited. You belong. Mephibosheth, even though you've not mattered to anyone else, it seems you matter to me. In response to being seen, Mephibosheth has fear and he has shame. And David's contrast with that, David's action against that, is simply to speak his name. It says, I see you and I value you. It's this powerful, powerful moment that starts to change the story and the life of Mephibosheth. Not only that, but David does a second thing. David blesses him. He acts for Mephibosheth in verses 9 through 13. Listen to this. He says, then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's steward, and said, I've given your master's grandson, this is Mephibosheth, everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him and bring in the crops so that your master's grandson may be provided for. And Mephibosheth, grandson of your master, will always eat at my table. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, your servant will do whatever my lord the king commands his servants to do. So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah, and all the members of Ziba's household were servants of Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table. He was lame in both feet. Not only did David name him, but David blessed him. David, in other words, acted for him. He says, I'm going to restore to you all of the land. Mephibosheth went from living in a corner of the kingdom, forgotten, filled with fear and shame, now to becoming incredibly wealthy and living in the center of the kingdom in Jerusalem. He says, I'm going to give it all to you, back to you. I'm going to give you people to work it, which would have been an immense blessing for someone who was lame in both feet. So now he gets to go out, and there are going to be people working for him, providing this land and working this land for him. And not only that, but he's going to be a regular at the table of the king. He's going to be a regular with David and the people close to him. Now some commentators say, well, this was David's way of kind of keeping an eye on his enemy. Maybe, but I like to think, at least how the story's gone so far, that this is an act of grace. That this is David saying, I see you and who you are, and you're in. You belong. You're worthy. And I'm going to act in ways that are for you. David invited him to the table of the king. I can even imagine, can you just even kind of imagine that moment where everyone's sitting across this giant, I imagine this giant banquet hall table kind of thing. Maybe it wasn't necessarily like that, but that's how I like to picture it. And all these people sitting there waiting, and David saying, hey, oh, and there's someone else coming, and here comes Mephibosheth, and maybe he's on his crutches coming in, maybe, he's being carried in. Either way, but there's this moment where Mephibosheth is there belonging with everyone else who belongs. And the change that would have brought for him, the change where his life takes a new direction. When I was in college, I spent two different seasons, 6 months each, where I was on crutches. I had corrective foot surgery, 6 months on one foot, 6 months on the other. And it was a fascinating experience. I had never been on crutches, hadn't broke a bone or anything, and this was a choice, but it was a fascinating experience being on crutches for that long. One, I got to park really close, so that was kind of nice. Two, I got to learn how to, drive with my left foot, which I don't know if that's really legal, so we'll go ahead and edit that part out for later. I also found that people were generally nice, which, you know, I didn't fully expect, especially at a college campus. Everyone's kind of focused on their own life, but people would wait and hold the door if their door was over there and I'm crutching over as fast as I can. People would hold the door and wait for me, which was really, really sweet. But probably the thing I take away most from that entire experience, that year total on crutches, was I never realized how much I carried. You know, just like basic stuff. Just imagine how much you carry throughout your day. For example, like I lived in an apartment with, we had several guys in several different bedrooms. And so if I wanted to do laundry, prior to crutches, I would take my laundry from my bedroom and go to our laundry area by the kitchen. Crutches, you can't do that. So I had to figure out, like, I put my laundry in a bag, put the bag over me, crutched over to the, I mean, all that little, those little things that you don't think about how much you carry. When I read this story of David and Mephibosheth, and there's so much more we could get into it with it, I think about how much Mephibosheth carried. Now, I don't mean the stuff that he carried. I just mean, like, what was going on in his world that he was carrying and carrying for years. The burden, the fear, the shame, the messages that others had told him, the messages that he had told himself, and how much that moment where David said, I want you here. And when David speaks his name, oh, you're Mephibosheth. I see you. You get to be a part of this. And what that moment would have done for Mephibosheth. I imagine how much he carried, and I imagine this moment where he was able to put all of that down. That all the ways that he had seen he was unworthy, that he doesn't belong, that David says, no, you get to be a part of this. You're part of the family now. You're a part of the royalty. You're part of this inclusion. You're in because I speak your name. David acted like God acts. He acted with hesed, with kindness. And by doing so, David named Mephibosheth. He says, I see your humanity. You matter to me. And David blessed him. He acted in ways that would better Mephibosheth, that would reroute his story for good. We've got a couple friends with us, some mission partners that CPC has right here in our local area who are doing this kind of work, who are acting in ways of bringing kindness to people's stories. So I want to invite these guys out, and I want to talk for them a little bit. They're going to share a little bit about their experience in the ministries that they do, in ways that kindness and naming people and blessing them, the ways that they've seen God reroute some stories. So actually, I'm going to let you guys go ahead and introduce yourselves. Tell us a little bit about your ministry, and then I want to talk about how you've seen kindness at work. But let's go ahead and start with who you are and what you guys are doing.
Great, cool. My name is Eric Chen. I'm an area director for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. InterVarsity is a national collegiate ministry, and we're all around the nation, but the particular campuses that I oversee are in the East Bay, so San Jose State, Cal State East Bay, up to Diablo Valley College in Pleasant Hill.
And I'm Albert Lee. I'm the CEO of Support Circle Pregnancy Clinics. We have three medical clinics where we provide medical care for women in unplanned pregnancies. We have a clinic in Redwood City, in San Francisco, and in Oakland.
Yeah, thank you guys for being here. And I think it's a great week to hear from these guys because they're like I said, acts of kindness going on, this kind of kindness going on right around us. And so to have you guys here to talk about the ways it's going on locally. Could you tell us a little bit about how you see kindness playing out in your ministry, some ways that you've seen it transform people. And I kind of want to leave this a little bit open-ended for you guys to kind of just share whatever's on your heart. And I've got a few more questions, but I'd really love for people just to hear your story. So can you think it through ways that maybe you've seen as you've named people, so to speak, or as you move towards them and kind of the change that's brought? So.
Yeah, kindness is just something always on our minds because when women come to our medical clinics, they're often under so much pressure from the people around them, wanting them to do this or to do that, internal pressure. And one of the most common phrases that we'll hear from our patients is, "My life is over." Mm. That's so common. I can't tell you how many times we hear that, you know, pretty much with everyone. They'll say, "I'm not ready, I'm nervous, this and that," but the thing that really comes out is, "My life is over." So meeting them where they are and meeting them with kindness is huge because it allows them the space to kind of start talking about what's going on and what's making them conflicted.
Wow.
Yeah, and I work with college students, so many of them transition into sort of a new environment. I'm thinking particularly about the new students who come into our space. And so a lot of our ministry is trying to help our older students think through the question, how do we be most loving to people who are transitioning to this new stage of life? As we meet new students, we're trying to help them think through, how do we be loving with people who are around us, people who we've never met before, or people that might look really different than us? One story that I have that just happened maybe about a month ago was at a camp that we had studying the book of Mark, the Gospel of Mark. And we had a student who came this year who was on the autism spectrum. And as we chatted with her campus staff and other students, the question we kept asking is, how can we be most loving to her? How can we be most loving to Julie and help her engage in the text? And it was so fun to see and hear at the end of our week at our staff debriefing, where we just had story after story of students from other campuses who didn't know Julie, who sat alongside with her, who helped engage her when she was just stuck in one place in Scripture, and to be able to see her walk in Scripture in such a rich way for the week.
It's beautiful. Can you talk a little bit, do you have experience, or can you tell examples of ways that like fear and shame have you seen, how you have seen that impact people? And just kind of as we draw that contrast with kindness, and how is that kind of, how is fear and shame burden people in your experiences?
Yeah, I would say the fear and shame are the main things that are driving abortion. People often don't think clearly when they're stressed out, when they're afraid, and so we deal with that all the time. In fact, there's actually a connection between the economy and the abortion rate, and people don't get that. When the economy goes south, abortion goes way up, and we see that directly every day in our medical clinics because it's fear, and it's fear of different kinds. It's fear about the future. We have a lot of college students about wanting to finish their education, accomplish their dreams, and now this unplanned pregnancy is a disruption. They don't know what to do with it. They don't know how to figure everything out, so they're stuck in this fear. And it could be fear of what other people think about them, people who are important in their life. It could be their parents. It could be their partner, their spouse. It could be their coworkers or their friends. There's just lots of fear about what will they think. And then there's self-doubt. I mean, something you said, actually, the thing about being unlovable really spoke to me because there's a lot of self-judgment that our patients have before they've even come to us. And in fact, one comes to mind, this woman, young woman named Emily, and she never imagined herself having kids, never wanted kids, and now she found herself pregnant. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, this was threatening her identity, her self-identity, and she didn't know what to do with that. And then her fiancé couldn't relate to that. Mm-hmm. Her fiancé wanted the baby and couldn't believe that she would consider having an abortion, and wasn't able to hear her, wasn't able to just understand her pain, her struggle. So what happened was she had no space to express any of that. And she began, then that increased her fear, actually. Mm. And one of the things she said to our nurses, to our nurse, she said, if things are this bad before the baby, if he can't even listen to me and understand how I'm feeling right now, how bad is it going to be when we have the baby? So just ironically, that was increasing her fear. Mm. And she felt like she wasn't being heard. She couldn't express herself.
That reminds me, just a short story from our side, as you were sharing, Albert. I think of a dynamic at San Jose State this year. We have two campus ministers there, a multi-ethnic strategic ministry, a Black campus strategic ministry, to engage in different kind of corners of the campus. And historically, they haven't partnered very much together. And through prayer and worship, we were sensing kind of this invitation to partner together more deeply. But when I was talking with my multi-ethnic ministry student leaders, I just kept hitting roadblocks with them, you know, question after question, and sort of, how do we do this? How can we engage here? And as we dove a little bit deeper, I just realized, there's a level of shame and fear of not knowing how to relate or not knowing how to have conversation. And so we just went back into prayer and worship and asked Jesus, how are you inviting us? What are you inviting us to become like? And one of the things that we got out of that was this sense that God and Jesus, he was naming us right, as we are these people on campus, and he's called us to live in partnership with Black Campus Ministries too. And so what it culminated in was a group lunch together or group dinner together. Yeah. And so there's 20 folks, 10 from the multi-ethnic side, 10 from the Black Campus Ministry side. And we get together for dinner. And afterwards, it was just so amazing to hear these stories of like, I know these people now, right? Like, we are known to one another, and we can care for one another, right?
So that's beautiful. Well, thank you guys very much. Thank you for the ways that you're speaking and acting in ways of kindness to combat fear and shame and to bring the love of Jesus to people all around you. Can we give them a hand real quick? These guys will be in the lobby if you want to talk to them more and hear more about their ministries and the ways that God is at work through them. But I loved even that image that Eric just shared with us, that sitting around the table where you're seeing someone. I mean, can you imagine David inviting Mephibosheth to the table, and now everyone gets to learn his name. Now everyone gets to see him for who he is. When I read this story of Mephibosheth, it's not only an amazing story, the way that David acted, but it's also a picture, I think, of how God has acted towards each of us. I mean, the biblical narrative, as people start to put the piece together and start to put Jesus and what he brings to the story in place, they begin to speak about Jesus and his view of you in this way. That God has acted with hesed, that God has acted with this immense life-changing kindness towards people like you and me. That though we didn't deserve it, he moved towards us in the person of Jesus. That he knows you and sees you. That you're invited in. It doesn't matter if you live in Lodabar. It doesn't matter what your past has been. He invites you to a new kind of relationship. Now, for many of us, maybe we've heard that, maybe you've heard that often. You kind of go, yes, I've heard that, but kind of the way life works is I don't hear that. Like, I've heard it, and then I don't hear it. And you kind of maybe get to this place where you just think, where maybe God's kind of forgotten it a little bit. Well, you know, the people of God, they thought this at times. In fact, there's this amazing passage in Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, where he's speaking for the people, and the people, in kind of in his own words, are saying, "Hey God, you have forsaken us." It said, "The Lord has forgotten me," and then God responds back to them in these words. He says, "I will not forget you. See, I have engraved you on the palms of my hands." You get to a point where you feel like you're unlovable. You get to a point like you feel like you're unworthy. You get to a point where you feel like you don't belong at the table. I'll just head back home to Lodabar. But that's contrasted with the God who says, there's absolutely no way I could ever forget you. Even this image of him writing your name on the palm of his hand. You're not forgotten. This is the type of God who's moving toward you. This is the type of God who sees you. It says, Mephibosheth, oh, excellent, I've been waiting for you. That's my hope for you today. That's my hope, is that you would hear a God speaking your name, seeing you in your humanity, and calling you to something more. Because that's the one other thing about this story I didn't tell you earlier. An interesting thing about this story is Mephibosheth's name. Mephibosheth's name is an interesting name, as you can tell, because I can barely pronounce it. But the name means something you probably wouldn't expect. The name Mephibosheth means shame destroyer. Isn't that amazing? The name Mephibosheth means shame destroyer. It means before all of his life unfolded, before the tragedy with the nurse dropping him, before the outcast to the corner of the kingdom, before all the messages that people told him and that he told himself, before all of that happened, he was a shame destroyer. And then life took a turn he wasn't expecting, and he lived in shame. But David called him by his name and called him to live into that name. David spoke his name. You're not shame. You are Mephibosheth, shame destroyer. Maybe the most gracious thing that you need to hear of is that God speaks your name. Maybe the most gracious thing that you could do for someone this week is to speak their name. Because when you do, you are following in this kind of hesed, this kind of kindness. You are calling people to who they were created to be. That is what God has done for you in Jesus. That's my hope for you today. Is that before you leave today, that you just have a moment. Maybe it's you alone with God. Maybe it's you with some of our prayer team there and in the back later. Maybe it's you with somebody, someone in your family, someone in your friend circle, that you just say, I need to hear this, and have someone pray for you. Maybe you need to speak those words to God yourself in a few minutes. You need to hear him, that he has spoken over you. He has spoken to you. He has seen you in your humanity and has called you to the table. And you say, why? I can't get there. I live too far away. I've been too much on the outside. I've been too forgotten. I've said too much and done too much. No. But this is the God who says, yes, I see that and I'll deal with that. And he's dealt with that in Jesus and now carries you to his table. You're not on the outside. You're not unworthy. You're not unlovable. You've been called by the God of the universe. Mephibosheth, that's you. I want to pray for us, and then we're going to sing a little bit as we close. Let's pray. God, thank you for story and people like Mephibosheth, people like David, who chose to act in kindness. People who show us a new way. People who give us hope. People who speak a new kind of story that we could live into. May we start with you, God. May we start by believing something better and different about how you see us. And would we be people that live in this world that carry on this kindness toward others. Not simply because that's the right thing to do, but because it might change someone's story. Thank you that you carried us to a place of communion with you. That in the midst of our brokenness, that in the midst of our past, in the midst of everything we've done and what's been done to us, you spoke something different. And you still speak something different. May we hear that name, our name, spoken by you, that we're not forgotten by you. It's not possible. We're written on the palm of your hand. Would you speak that new to us as we find ways in this world to speak that to others?